Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. You can visit our website for podcasts of previous programmes and other details of the series. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Later on this week's programme.
New curriculum is with us over 10 years now and they still haven't got around to designing schools to match the curriculum so that you can bring children out and explore habitats.
We welcome back an old friend of the programmes, environmentalist and educator Paddy Madden, who will talk about opportunities and challenges for teaching about springtime. But first, Barry Hennessy has been looking at language teaching in post-primary schools.
Hello again, Sean. Well, what languages should be taught in Irish schools and what factors should influence that choice? If commerce and trade considerations come into it, Mandarin Chinese should surely be at the top of our priorities into the future. The Confucius Institute is a Chinese government body charged with promoting Chinese language and culture around the world. Together with the NCCA, it's designed a transition year course in Chinese language and culture that's now being rolled out nationwide. And here to tell us about it this week is James Kenny, who's Assistant Director at the Confucius Institute in UCD. You're very welcome, James.
Thank you.
How many schools have signed up to it and how's it going?
Well, we started off piloting this project in 2007, and from only a handful of schools in 2007, it grew to over 20 schools last year and has doubled to over 40 schools this year. And from the inquiries we're getting so far, we anticipate this figure to at least double again to next year, over double this figure. And in that situation, we would like to not be in a situation that we have to say no to any of the schools. So we would be looking for more support and funding from the government to keep it going and to broaden the scope of the project.
Are the schools located nationwide?
Yes, the schools go from Wexford all the way to Mayo. We have schools that are fee-paying and non-fee-paying. We have DESH schools, disadvantaged schools, and We cover every aspect of the secondary schooling system.
Now, it's a 45-hour course, as I understand it, but I believe that you go to considerable efforts when a school contacts you with a view to tailoring the course to what the school is actually able to deliver.
Yes, one of the key words in our project is flexible. We like to work together with the school to tailor the course specifically to the school's needs. So whatever their restraints are as regards budget or time, we work with them and make sure that they're happy.
Right, because the course is divided into a language element and a culture element, as you've mentioned. But the language element, I mean, the issue there being clearly that there aren't going to be too many teachers in Irish schools who would have a knowledge of Chinese. So who is there to teach the language?
So we have a number of teachers, volunteer teachers, who are sent over by our headquarters in China. And we send out these teachers to all the schools nationwide. Obviously, this is not enough to cover, especially with the kind of figures that we're talking about. So we are looking at trying to encourage Chinese people living in Ireland that are qualified to teach the language, trying to encourage them to join in our project as well. And obviously, to keep it going, we need to have more support and funding so that we can broaden the scope of the project.
The resources were developed in cooperation with the NCCA, as I understand it. What kind of efforts were gone into to try and make them, I suppose, relevant to the needs of Irish teenagers?
Well, we've done exhaustive research on this aspect of it. We've tried to tailor it, again, to Irish students' needs. Literally hundreds of hours of research and feedback sessions have gone into tailoring the course material specifically for Irish students. As you pointed out, we're working with the NCCA on this and they have very strict guidelines and we've worked with them and done it specifically to those regulations.
Because, I mean, one of the things that teachers who teach transition years will sometimes tell you is that there's always going to be X number of them who will think it's a dossier. There are parents out there that sometimes assert that as well. You want to keep them occupied, and you want to keep them active in the learning process. What kind of teaching methodologies are in play here to try and I suppose, ensure that the interest of the learners is kept as high as possible in what they're doing?
Yes, you've made a very good point there that it's very important to keep the students interested in what you're doing, to keep them engaged. So we have tried to use every kind of methodology in the teaching materials. We have online materials, workshops, games, indoor and outdoor activities, face-to-face materials, role-playing, DVDs, movies, and so on. Everything is in there, really. One of our schools in the North Inner City, which through their funding has bought iPads for their students, and the students can have access to the vast amount of materials there is online to study Chinese, and they love studying through the medium of the iPad. Kids love the iPads. Another example would be one of our schools in Mayo, which is actually learning Chinese through Irish. So these kind of developments are fascinating, and these will be all showcased in the NCCA conference, which is in association with our institute at the end of April.
The whole broader issue, James, of Chinese, I mean, it's one of those things that is mentioned so often at the moment in the context of the country's skills needs into the future. Is there any work going on behind the scenes at the moment with a view to getting Mandarin Chinese into the curriculum more generally?
Yes, we've been, again, working with the NCCA on this too. As we know, Minister Quinn is reforming junior cycle at the moment, and he's brought in the long course and short course design. With the NCCA, we're in the process of designing a short course to fill in with his plan. So from 2014, this will be officially launched, and we're going to be piloting this in a number of schools from this September, so that we're ready to go in 2014 when it rolls out.
Have those schools already been selected, or is there scope for schools that are interested maybe to contact yourselves with a view to being included?
We're always interested to hear from any schools, whether they want to pilot the short courses or whether they're interested in the cultural or language element of what we do.
That's James Kenny from UCD, from the Confucius Institute there, and that's it from me for this week.
Thanks very much for that, Barry. And Barry will, of course, be back with another feature on next week's Inside Education. You are indeed listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Our website is insideed.com, where you can download podcasts of 128 Inside Education programmes. Paddy Madden is a born teacher and communicator. His enthusiasm for nature and the environment is infectious. Whether he's talking about school gardens or bud walks, experiments with potatoes or studying the life cycle of the frog, he is knowledgeable and passionate about his subject. Paddy has been a guest on the programme before, but given that spring is well and truly in the air now, I thought it would be good to invite Paddy back and ask him what teachers need to know and what they can do in springtime. Having spent many years as a primary school teacher in Donore Avenue, Paddy is now retired from the classroom. But he is busier than ever and still involved with education at the Merino Institute of Education, where he works with student primary teachers, at the Blackrock Education Centre, where the website features a section called Paddy's School Garden, and through regular visits to classrooms all around the country. When I met up with Paddy, I started by asking him why it is important for a teacher to pay attention to the changing seasons when they are planning work for their class.
Well, the scheme is written, isn't it? For the year, spring, summer, autumn and winter. Spring, the earth is waking up. It's the awakening. Summer, it's blooming. Autumn, it's retreating. And in the winter, it's sleeping. So if you tune in children into nature and into the seasons, they get a sense of themselves, and they get a sense of the world around them. And they get connected to the world around them, which makes life extremely interesting as they watch the changes throughout the year.
And for you, Paddy, does spring begin at the start of February or the start of March?
Spring begins when I start reciting Anishchak Donarig Vegon Laig Dolcon Shine, Istoresh Nefela Bride Ardoi Me Mojol. O Quermen Machiaune, Nestopic Me Quihe, Goshasimishis, Ilor Conte Vio. That song or that poem by Antonin Raftery always reminds me of the Bora, the movement, the beginnings. And when I start reciting it, it means that there's something in the air. The light is increasing. The bird song is increasing. Buds are beginning to wonder, will we come out now or will we stay in? The snowdrops are certainly blooming. And that's spring to me. It's not a date, it's a feeling. It's a feeling that comes in. And when I just want to get out there and I want to join too in the growth and in the beginnings.
And from a practical point of view then, what kind of things can a teacher do to mark that excitement of spring when it comes around each year?
Wonder. Isn't that an amazing thing? Brian McMahon talks about opening windows of wonder to children. I always think of that when I'm talking to the students. Can you open windows of wonder? And it's just a great bit of magic a teacher can have to do that. Wonder leads on to excitement. Excitement leads to exploration. And exploration leads to discovery. So, what would I do first in spring? I would bring them out of the classroom, to the living classroom outside, which is not exploited half enough. And I would get them to look at the buds of the trees first. I would do a bud walk with them, not a bird walk, a bud walk, where we would observe the buds, the different sizes, shapes, texture. And then I might get them to do a bit of PE to integrate with it and say, get the children together and say, 1, 2, 3, find a beach for me, and let them run and find the beach and maybe give them a point if they all stood under the beech or the chestnut. And then maybe come inside and do a poem, you know, that lovely poem by Aileen Fisher, All Winter in the tree buds, the little leaves lie packed with tiny coats of emerald green, all folded and exact. And when the time is ready, I wonder how they know. They quietly unfold and grow and grow. I would do that lovely poem with them, which would integrate with what we were doing out. And then I would definitely, I don't think I ever was in any class that I had that I didn't have the great bud hunt, where we'd take the different buds then that they had looked at. And of course, children are often surprised that trees all have different buds. Even the students I have here are surprised too. But we would put them into different jars, seven different labels, seven different dates, and then I would get the children to predict which of these buds would open first. And we'd open a book, and they would, I can tell you, those children would know those seven buds in a few weeks, because every morning they'd come in and they'd say, oh, look at the ash, oh, it's not opening yet, or look at the chestnut. Now, oh God, your bud is winning, I wonder will yours catch up. You're teaching them by default, nearly by trickery, which of course a good teacher does anyway. And so that always works, and it's opening a door, isn't it, to the world by just getting them to start with the buds of spring.
Supposing, Paddy, the teacher themselves is not sure of which buds belong to which tree, and I know you might find that unusual, but sometimes, you know, it might not be their thing. How can teachers themselves get this knowledge of the buds and the trees?
Yes, you're right. I'm flabbergasted sometimes when the new students come in here, even post-grads, you know, and I bring them out. I had them out yesterday. None of 60, not one recognised the rowan tree or the beech. Yes, where's the gap? Somewhere along the line, the environment has been dropped. And nature, I think probably with the new curriculum coming in, they concentrate on the physical sciences to the detriment of the natural science, thinking that I suppose the natural science is not the one that will promote jobs and industry and that. But of course, that's the wrong thinking altogether, because science starts outside the door of the classroom. It starts there with nature. Science starts with being inquisitive and being observant. And if you can promote those two skills in children, the rest of the science follows.
Is there a book or a website that you would recommend?
Again, this, you see, goes against what I've just said. There are loads of books and loads, but there's nothing like actual physical touching. And this is the type of education we should be promoting more and more as education becomes virtual and more virtual. Nothing against it. I'm a real advocate of IT in the classroom, the interactive board, the potential. The internet, everything. But you have to have the real thing as well. You just have to smell and touch. You have to use your senses. You have to absolutely cultivate that in children, using their senses from the very young. And by using their senses, like I said there, it cultivates love and interest and enthusiasm from an early age. And something that you love to smell or to touch at a very young age remains with you all your life. And for all your life, that thing becomes an object of wonder and love and something that gives you pleasant memories. Probably one that appeals to a lot of teachers now is the short video. A very short video that has a story, a very short story board in it, maybe sort of six items in your story. Those seem 1.5 minutes long. They seem to be appealing more and more to teachers, and they can download them on their iPads and their smartphones and that going into teaching the bus or whatever. And so in Blackrock Education Centre, we have set up a site there on the Blackrock EC.ie. It's called Paddy's School Garden, and there are about 60 short videos in there on how to. And one of the things you would how to at this time of the year would be how to sprout potatoes in the classroom. And basically, it's simply getting an egg carton and putting new potatoes into the egg carton and putting it in a shady part and of the class, and the children observe them, the little sprouts coming on them. And then you sow them around Patrick's Day, which is traditional in Ireland, and then you harvest them in the June. You can have a potato harvest. I know of schools have had potato parties, and they have Coupe Concannon and Boxty and Pound, which is a Clare dish. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but that's one. So definitely that's a journey, isn't it? From the sprouting potato to the full-blown eating of it. Another one that you could get children at this time of the year is to sprout peas and beans and in the classroom, but especially peas. These are edible and they're nutritious. The ordinary pea and the mange too. In a lot of the commercial books up that you see up there are sheep and lambs. I mean, what do children know about sheep and lambs mainly? They don't. They see them in the distance. But a bud, that's outside hopefully every school, though I wonder. And I have to hear get very cross about the kind of designs that goes into the modern school. The modern schools are beautiful on the inside. You have to agree there. They have fantastic computer rooms, they have wide spaces, corridors, light, huge storage in the classroom, magnificent teachers' rooms. But look on the outside. No planning. They get somebody to come in and they'll stick down a few trees. I was in a brand new school recently and every tree there was a lime tree. Now, is that encouraging children to go out and explore trees? Is it encouraging biodiversity in schools? New curriculum is with us over 10 years now and we still haven't got around to designing schools to match the curriculum so that you can bring children out and explore habitats. I mean, every school, every new school that's out there should have a little mini wood, for example. And this time of the year, you can, very shortly, you can watch the ground or the flower layer emerging, the bluebells and the primroses and the violets, you know. And then later on, you can see the leaf coming in, and later on, then the berries in the autumn. Sure, I mean, that's an open book you have there. But there are very few open books, I can tell you, out there in the modern designs of schools. There are wonderful landscapers there, which if they were given a little bit of guidance, that they would actually do this. But they don't get guidance. They just come in. I was in another school recently. All these are very modern schools I'm talking about, where the cherry laurel, this awful thing that has replaced Lelandy, has been planted everywhere around the school, all around the verges and in the schools. And, of course, the cherry laurel is deadly poisonous, you know, and the berries on it, deadly, and the leaf.
Does that mean that you won't get bird life there?
Absolutely not. Nothing. The place are dead. There's no native trees. Even that school with the lime tree. The lime tree is not native to Ireland, even in England. I mean, you have about 28 different trees and shrubs there that should be planted to attract wildlife into a school grounds and encourage biodiversity. Every school should have a nectar patch, for example, to encourage in bumblebees and butterflies. You know, there's certain plants that attract all these things.
What would you put in a nectar patch?
Well, in a nectar patch, you would put in plants that would be full of nectar, like the Buddleia, the Davidia. It comes from China. And you probably have seen huge, big purple flowers in the summer, and butterflies milling around it. And Hebe is another one, and Verbena. You'd also put in a big pot of nettles, or you could put them into some container, because when the butterflies are finished drinking the nectar, especially butterflies like the red admiral, the small tortoiseshell, and the peacock, they will look for somewhere to lay eggs. Now, they won't lay eggs on any plant, but then those three butterflies lay eggs on nettles. You have nettles there. Okay, they mightn't lay eggs on it, but you can at least show the children that this is how you encourage biodiversity, by having plants for the adult butterflies and also plants for the young ones. And then the same with birds. There are certain plants, you know, and they're non-native, some of them, but the most one that comes to mind, of course, is the hawthorn. There should be hawthorns planted around schools. There should be blackthorns for the sloes, right? The rowan tree. Brilliant one, full of berries, you know, and blackberries and black currants. And oh dear me, I could go on. I have written the third edition of the Go Wild at School has just been published, and that has everything you want to know about biodiversity in a school ground. If a school sort of adhered to what's in the different chapters there. And the book was first published in 1996, believe it or not. And now it's third edition in full colour. And all based on my experience in that wonderful school in Dunor Avenue in the South Circular, where we had the first wildlife garden in Ireland.
How much does the book cost, Paddy?
Sure, it's for nothing. €15 plus £2.50 P&P. And it's available from paddy.madden@mie.ie.
And you'll accept cheques or postal orders or anything, Visa?
I will accept anything except snails and wildlife in barter. So,
we've talked a lot about plant life, Paddy. Is there anything that can be done to look at animal life by the teacher at this time of the year?
Oh, I mean, this time of the year, it's the awakening, isn't it? Again, the frogs have woken up and they're mating and in the ponds. Well, they have mated by now, and the ponds are full of frog spawn. And teachers might know that. Some people don't. There's a kind of an urban myth where it came from that you can't bring frog spawn into a classroom anymore. Of course you can. All primary teachers have a license from the department, which you can actually download and put up on your door in case someone comes in and says you can't. So it's there. Once you act responsibly, set up an aquarium in the classroom, don't have too much frog spawn. Let the children observe them hatching out. You know, all they need is pond weed until they get their legs. And then when they develop their hind legs, they become carnivores. And you don't have to give them a big bit of bloody mince or something like that. You just go down to your local garden centre and buy some daphnia or water fleas. No, the stuff you feed the goldfish, and give them a pinch of that every day. And you can watch them swimming around with their legs. And then when they turn into frogs, you put in a stone in there for to sit on, and put some kind of a mesh on top, because a frog can escape out of the aquarium, but put it back then into the pond from which it came. That's very important, because if you don't do that, you can actually spread a virus around among frogs. So it's just to be on the hygienic side, always bring back that the grown frog to the pond from which you took the tadpole. So that's definitely something that we should get the children to do when you're looking at a life cycle.
Would you want to change the water in the aquarium from time to time?
Very important, very, very important. You can get a tube and just suction, do a bit of suction, suck the water out at least once a week, and put in fresh pond water or rain water. Don't use the tap water because it's chlorine in it and fluoride, and frogs are extremely sensitive creatures to any kind of chemicals. That's why they're a barometer of wildlife. If the frogs are plentiful, it means that chemicals are not being used, or poisons or pesticides around. So it's the same with your pond water. Chlorine has a terrible effect on them. So bring in sort of leave a few bottles of rainwater in the classroom, so it'll be the same temperature as your aquarium, and also our pond water. If you go into the Black Rock website again, Paddy's School Garden, it shows you how to set up an aquarium, how to care for tadpoles, and how to keep the aquarium clean. Another thing you can do at this time is definitely looking at snails. Have just emerged from sleep all winter. Children mightn't realise that, but they haven't been around. And if they haven't been around, the hedgehog hasn't been around either, because the hedgehog eats slugs and snails. So the hedgehogs are emerging from hibernation, and so are the snails. So it's a nice thing to set up a snailery in the classroom. And again, instructions on that website, and fascinating for children to observe the snails. And maybe you might get them to lay eggs. And of course, children are always amused when I say, "Oh, you shouldn't have called that snail he. Oh, I should. No, not she either. It's it, you know." Always, never insult a snail by calling it a he or a she. It has to be an it. And they look up and say, "But why?" "Oh, because a snail is both male and female. And here's a big word which you have no trouble remembering and telling your parents you learned it in school today. A hermaphrodite." Okay, we'll write that down on the board. Hermaphrodite. "And can anyone tell me another hermaphrodite?" "Oh, the worm is..." "Oh, yes, indeed it is." So they're fascinated with that. And then I give them a little quiz maybe, and I say, "I wonder how many names we can think up suitable for a snail, you know." So they'll come up with Alex and Pat, you know, and Sam, that suit both boy and girl. And I keep telling them, you know, I have a record in my head of some school that has 23 names, and they keep trying to beat it. So it's fascinating to keep the snailery.
Paddy ended up our conversation by reciting a poem that expresses some of his beliefs about education.
It's a poem by David Poels, and I'll read it out. It says, "Must we always teach our children with books? Let them look at the stars and the mountains above. Let them look at the water, the trees, the flowers of the earth. Then they will begin to think, and to think is the beginning of real education."
And that was Paddy Madden from the Merino Institute of Education, finishing our interview for today. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes at insideed.com or on iTunes. Thanks to my guest, Paddy Madden, and to my colleague, Barry Hennessy, for his report on languages. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.